18th, the year 2000, interviewing Josh Lederberg in his office at the Rockefeller University in New York City. We're going to begin this interview today. Let's start with the same place that your involvement with the space program began, with the issue of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked with several people about how you became interested in contamination, discussing Calcutta and the possibilities of nuclear radiation and things on the moon. But what did you see is at stake in these contamination arguments for scientists or for the public or for the national prestige, however you'd like to interpret that?
Well, I saw planetary inquiry as a very important scientific domain. All the kinds of questions that have come up and are continued to be investigated at the present time. And I didn't want to see something as foolish as generating or dropping a load of radioactive waste, which could interfere in all kinds of ways with the further pursuit of doing the science. And then a little less likely that would be revealed later on, but even dropping packages of spores, which is what a decaying organism would represent. Later expeditions recovered evidence of microbial life. You wouldn't want to be plagued with the concern that they were simply the garbage deposits of the previous expedition. But above all, I was perturbed that the whole program seemed to give no thought at all to the scientific aspects of exploration. It was all a circus for amusement. I thought this would be an emblematic way of presenting that, and to try to put some piece of the program on a much sounder scientific footing, make it a serious human effort. Now, the other side was, this was a moral equivalent of war, and far better for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to show their determination that there were going to be no limits in what they were willing to expend for their security, which was demonstrated even to a large degree by defense expenditures, but also by NASA, and that they each did have the technological capability to ensure mutual assured destruction. And since that was not a very credible prospect without some sort of technological demonstration, better that it be in space than it be another Hiroshima or another Nagasaki. So I saw those as mitigating aspects of what I call the circus.
Okay. Did you encounter much resistance in pushing for contamination? And if so, what kind of people who resisted that or sterilizing probes, what kind of...
Well, I was actually surprised at how much consensual support I did get. I would say that 90% of the people that I talked to, and must have been somewhat selected, but not grossly, caught on right away and were anywhere from lukewarm to warm to very enthusiastic supporters. Look at the names of the groups that we've got on the committees.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there were only two figures that I can recall that were quite outstanding, that were adamantly opposed to bringing this up. One was Phil Abelson, and the other was George Gaylord Simpson. Phil, I think, was so brilliantly antagonized by the entire space program that he didn't want to see anything that might seem like constructive interest in it. So he was not particularly interested in making it better. He just didn't, he wanted to go away altogether. Simpson was a committed, terrestrially bound paleontologist, and he generated all kinds of arguments, none of which impressed me in the slightest, why life was such an improbable event that there was no point looking for it outside the Earth. Well, might have been improbable, but here we knew that it existed. So I really couldn't see much sense to the detail of his argument. But he and Abelson did form a numerically rather small club of people who poo-pooed the entire notion. But I would say it had astonishingly positive support. I was quite startled when I got rather prompt replies back from the higher officials of the National Academy and so on.
Mm-hmm. Were NASA and the military as equally supporting, or did they have...
This was a strictly NASA matter, mm-hmm. because planetary exploration was entirely a NASA mission.
Okay.
And has remained so.
Okay. Okay. This is a little more technical, but if you can recall, what were some of the differences between the initial sterilization and quarantine programs? There were different proposals, different levels of
Well, they went through a pretty systematic review, on the one hand, of trying to estimate what the microbial loads would be, what the chances of survival would be in environments like those of Mars, and then finally putting that together with what was an acceptable level of microbial contamination on the vehicle itself, so that with further attenuation generated an acceptable risk. And I don't recall what numbers we finally came down to fit into those equations, but I can tell you who would be able to provide them, and that's D. Warner North, who did a lot of the risk assessment tree work on that, and I was in touch with him not very long ago, so he's alive and kicking in California.
Okay. Initially, there was some disagreement among WestEx members about that, and I'm thinking specifically, there seemed to be a conflict between Norman Horowitz and Aaron Novick about whether you should be asking for quarantine or sterilization. And Horowitz at least voiced his opinion that discussing this problem too much might turn off the public to the space program.
Well, I forgot the latter motive to it. I know that he was probably closer to lukewarm.
Uh-huh.
I think partly his skepticism about whether there was anything to look for anyhow. He had his own prior views, and he's written them up in his book, and it's Utopian Back, so you can get his views very clearly in that direction. To this day, he thinks the matter is settled, that we know for sure that there is no life on Mars. I've tried to keep a somewhat more open mind about it. I was never sure there was. People have asked me, why did I put so much energy into a program I didn't have a strong conviction? And my answer is, it was the question that was important.
Mm-hmm.
And until the question was settled, it really didn't matter what I believe the answer was. It was important to have a process in place that could provide a credible answer.
Okay. WestEx had at one point proposed contracting with Fort Detrick to make a detection device.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about how that idea originated and how it was received?
I don't remember the outcome. I recall that as I looked into the literature of decontamination and so on, it seemed to me that most of the practical work in that direction was going on there, and they were also very interested in sensors for detecting microbial activity. I think they had a lot of published information that was useful. I don't believe that they actually ever participated programmatically in the effort, but I can't be certain about that.
But would it have been a problem for the civilian NASA, for NASA as a civilian agency, to be contracting with Fort Detrick at all? Because I know partially you were trying to encourage international cooperation.
Well, I may have been naive, but I think I felt as long as this is an open effort that you go where the expertise lies, maybe it would have had those problems of credibility and so on. I tend to take people at their words.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew quite a few of the people at Detrick. A lot of people who'd been at Detrick had come to the University of Wisconsin. Its faculty department was very close into it. Ira Baldwin had been a considerable figure on the advisory groups for the BW program, and that was still the offensive program in those days. He was also the Dean of Agriculture at the University of Wisconsin. And while I was less heated then, I might have been now, while I might have preferred that they were not into an offensive development program, I took them at their words. I thought they were honorable people, and they would do the best job they could in fulfilling this kind of requirement. And they were, Detrick was an instrument of national policy at that time, and they didn't make national policy.
Mm-hmm. You said you didn't know the outcome. Do you know if NASA did contract?
I don't think they ever did contract with them, but I'm not at all certain of that.
Okay.
I've never heard it mentioned again, and I've had a lot more to do with the BW program since the late 60s. There's a gap of 10 years that I wouldn't know much about, and it's never come up, but I have no guarantee on it.
Okay. By about 1962 or so, contamination seemed to be less of an issue that the Space Science Board was talking about all the time.
Well, it became accepted.
It became
formalized in international treaty and so forth.
Okay.
The CTEX agreement.
Right.
It didn't spell it out chapter and verse, but there was a formal agreement of mutual consultation and take great care. So it was acknowledged at the international level. Now, how far that was going to be implemented, we were very curious to know what the Russians' attitudes were. Were they serious about it, and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some were, some weren't.
Okay.
Same is true on our side.
Right. Okay. So now I have a few more general questions about kind of the Space Science Board, and a phrase that you used earlier, actually, which is sound scientific programs. And you mentioned that the whole enterprise seemed in some ways like a circus.
It's still
a circus. What did you have in mind for a sound scientific program, if there was a way that space exploration could be?
Well, for one thing, much more emphasis on the planets rather than sending people to the moon than sending people anywhere for that matter. Mm-hmm. Now, some science gets done in support of manned space travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't argue with that once we're, if the decision is made and settled that you're going to be putting people up there. I don't want to put them at risk. I don't want to put the country at risk by that failing. So that needed some scientific support as well. I just personally didn't have any great interest in having anything to do with it. So that's the bioastronautics side of it. But, you know, some good people did good work and trying to understand the space environment and what it would do to people and what would be needed for life support. But, well, I was eager that whatever was done be on a sound scientific basis. I would have preferred a much more vigorous scientific program that would have involved more sampling of material. I know qualms about return sample of moon material, and we can still use more of that in a more systematic role today. We don't need people for it particularly, mm-hmm. but it'll probably be done with people who have an excuse mm-hmm. for why you're sending them there. But then even more so when it comes to exploration of the planets, the planetary exploration on the one hand, and then astronomical inquiry. So the Hubble Observatory is a magnificent scientific accomplishment by every mm-hmm. account.
What did you see as biology's role among space science as compared to, say...
I couldn't see much besides meteorites, comets, and planets. I mean,
uh-huh.
it would be, at minimum, better evidence about what primordial organic chemical synthesis would look like.
Mm-hmm.
I got onto the other side of a, I won't call it a controversy, but a different line of interpretation with Urey and Miller, who saw the original organic molecules that were precursors to life originating by the action of ultraviolet light on a primitive terrestrial atmosphere. I saw an expanding universe, cycles of star formation, heavy element formation, supernova, re-expulsion, developing an interstellar plasma that contained mostly hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and then down to trace amounts of oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur,
mm-hmm.
the critical elements. You don't need a synthetic paradigm. The fact that these begin as isolated atoms, when they collide with one another, you've got organic chemistry in space going on a cosmic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we ought to look there for what the origins of organic molecular material. The only question is how do you get it from space to the surface of the Earth?
Mm-hmm.
That's still an ongoing issue, but there is cometary infall, there is meteoritic infall, and the pendulum's been oscillating from one extreme to the other about how much of the organic molecular burden on Earth could have come from external sources. And I think it's moving back again towards some credibility that quite a large component could well be accounted for that way,
mm-hmm.
rather than atmospheric sources once the Earth's atmosphere has become established. So you might call this cosmic versus terrestrial origin of organic molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Well, exploring those contingencies, I thought and think, is still a very important arena for NASA to be interested in. And now there's been microwave studies of organic molecules in space, and as our methodology gets better and better, more and more complex molecules are being mm-hmm. found by that spectroscopic route.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's controversial anymore. I think the and you have things like comets as reminders of those sorts of aggregates. How to get the organic molecular material on a comet, basically it's an issue of absorbing its gravitational energy without burning up everything that's in it. But some of it, plainly, does get through. If you get a meteorite mm-hmm. hitting Earth that you think came from Mars, then you can get cometary material
right.
with similar material. So there's still a lot of open issues.
Right. Some of the early proposed experiments just I was really struck by their confidence. For instance, in the design of the, I think it was called the Multivator, with the phosphatase.
Well, that was out of my lab.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Right.
Well, we wanted a uniform platform in which we could plug in a variety of different kinds of experiments. So that's the multi-part of Multivator.
Right.
So,
right. Right. Scientifically, would something for those assays to work? Would that require whatever macromolecules that have been out there to be
well,
in
well, it depends what you choose. Yeah. Actually, the problem would be more, there is phosphatase activity in mm-hmm. quite simple species. And as I reflect on it further, in an effort to try to choose the least unlikely substrate targets, we may have been laying ourselves open to a dilemma on the other side. You can get some phosphatase activity out of inorganic salts. So take your choice. But where are you going to draw the line? If you had to make a choice, if you stuck to DNAase, which might be a preferred assay to answer certain questions, it better be the right question.
Right.
If it's a different polymer, you might miss an elephant.
Right. Exactly.
So it's a very serious dilemma to know what degree of specificity to be looking for. So phosphatase was one of the choices, precisely because there are going to be many more phosphate substrates that the phosphatases we know can handle at some rate or another than there are going to be something as particular as deoxynucleotide polymers, which would be a wonderful signal to get, but what are the odds that it's the same kind of polymer?
Mm-hmm.
So you have all those trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. Did the Multivator actually go up in
there? No, we didn't choose that particular. You know, conceptual analogs of it were the other experiments.
Right.
But the experiments that are actually flown, there was no, I don't believe there was any single specific enzyme assay. There was a pretty broad metabolism assay in which labeled materials, labeled substrates, were provided, and if any of them decomposed, you'd be able to read the radioactive CO2 coming off. There again, we didn't give enough attention to inorganic artifacts that, in retrospect, certainly did cloud that issue. And the other was a CO2 fixation experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So we assume that's more likely to be a near universal. Whether they're colored green or not is another story, but there's a reason it's green. So.
Right. you had resisted, in some more administrative matters, you had strongly resisted combining the exobiology committees and the man in space committees. Do you recall with that?
Well, I thought they were a totally different agenda, and I didn't want to be giving political support to the man in space program. I wanted us to stand on our own feet and let them do the same. I also thought the talent involved was totally different. So I could see one's physiology, the other is molecular biochemistry.
Right. Was opposition to the man in space program fairly common?
It's hard to say. I don't know many working scientists who are enthusiastic for it. I think some people bought it as part of a broader political agenda. There was a small kernel of real space enthusiasts. I think Carl Sagan was probably pretty plus on it. I think he thought it would excite the public, and he was enough of a cowboy himself. He wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it covered a fairly broad spectrum. There's also a lot of opposition. Actually, there's a very interesting reprise. I'm going to try and get this out for you. I'm sure there have been more objective surveys on this and what people of varying degrees of education and professional interest. I don't recall them per se, but it covered a pretty broad spectrum, and the non-scientific motives did appeal to some number of scientists, as they're human beings in other aspects too. I think there was a lot of concern about draining budgets away. I also have to say NASA went over backwards to try to win the interest and support of the academic community. It had a lot of very broadly conceived university centers programs and so on. And Jim Webb was all for using spillover from NASA to improve university academic facilities and so on. So it had some constructive aspect as part of a political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for 10 years this was Jack Kennedy's dream, and I think his charisma caught up with a number of people. A lot of, likewise, you might say the anti-charisma of Sputnik. We have to do something to show we're up to that challenge. So the very complexly interwoven motives.
Okay.
I didn't think we needed men in space. I thought we could accomplish the political objectives equally well, but that's, what do I know about the political motif? But I did struggle pretty hard to try to get alternative agendas on the table.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering this political, what we needed to accomplish in space, I mean, in several cases you mentioned the need for international cooperation and that you really wanted to encourage kind of scientific cooperation in space. What did you see as possible?
Well, if we're going to do planetary inquiry, first of all, I didn't want the competitive spirit to override the cautionary aspect of it. Not only respect to contamination, I wanted the missions to work, and I didn't want there to be such heat about let's get there before the Russians do, that we cut corners in the process, and then the vice versa. So, total common sense in that regard. I also felt, no, not the scientist, the new scientist. And I thought it was also a place where, and it was indeed the case, you could have Russian physicists and American physicists talking to each other, and just incidentally that, you know, trying to work over other technical contributions to solutions of arms control programs, things of that sort. I'm sure Jerry Wiesner was very deeply imbued with that. He was science advisor to Johnson. And, but when I would bring up with him, the manned program, he basically said, you're wasting your time, the decision's been made, and I did my best. I didn't disagree with the judge, but I got to follow what the boss says. Mm-hmm. The decision's settled, so why don't you just go along with it?
Mm-hmm. How did you end your involvement with the SSB?
I don't recall. Is it still in existence? I mean, I think
Right.
sat in it for any number of terms, and
right.
The structure's changed a bit.
I was really struck by, in 1962, there was a change in leadership, and the NAS Seitz came in instead of Bronk, and I think Hess became the new chair of the SSB instead of Bergner. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like that there was a changing of the guard, and a lot of people were sent letters that, from a perspective looking at it now, it's kind of ambiguous of whether all of you had felt you had spent your time or if they wanted a different crew.
Oh, I had no problem with it. I spent my time.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't lack for influence if
right.
I needed it. So,
okay.
I certainly at no point felt abused or left out, and I was on any number of direct NASA committees and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I had more than my fill.
I'm sure. I'm
so
sure
that
you
was
did.
That wasn't an issue, and I was an active participant in the Viking project. So.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, besides the Space Science Board, I have a list of some of the other early federal advisory boards that you served on, including, you know, the Kennedy Health Team and doing some.
Can you hang on a minute?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So. Of the other advisory boards that you were serving on in kind of these years right after you went to Stanford, immediately after the Nobel Prize, including the Kennedy Health Team and later in the 70s, kind of the National Mental Health Council and various others, any that you find are important, which ones did you feel like were the most important of all of your early committee of federal policy work?
Well, it varies with epoch. That episode I told you about 1950 in the Genetic Society, I think was my first venture into political territory. It was pretty early in my career, actually, and I was astonished. Here I was 25 years old. I was 3 years into my first academic job, and I was being, put up against Mueller on a genetic society committee. But I guess I had spoken eloquently enough and so on that I had persuaded a number of people that that mine was closer to the voice of reason. It was somewhat painful for me to do that. I so deeply admired Mueller, and he'd been so kind to me personally, so there was no personal rancor of any kind, not even remotely so. He had a real buzz on this particular matter. Then, I guess I'm answering a somewhat broader question, but I see if I can get a reasonable chronological framework. In the mid-50s, I began to be missing my medical roots. I'd made a wrenching decision about not finishing medical school. I'd completed a PhD, sort of ex post facto, my work at Yale with Ed Tatum. Is this familiar to you?
That part about the medical, right.
And then took a job as an alternative to going back and getting my MD. At Columbia, took a job, which was a wise choice, at Wisconsin, in the genetics department, but it was a school of agriculture. There was no genetics in that or any other medical school at that time. So as I settled in at Wisconsin, got my lab going, got my teaching going, and so on, and the opportunities for being part of a medical research enterprise were expanding as the field was growing, I then certain sense got to be a little bit more political or policy oriented by moving towards the ensconcement of genetics in the medical curriculum and actually getting it organized as a self-standing department. And that was, I think, pretty much of an innovation in schools at that time. So that's 1955-56. That coincided with the arrival at Madison of John Bowers as the new dean. He'd been running some of the major radiobiology programs of AEC up to that time, so he was a beagle radiobiologist by background, biological effects of radiation. But this fit in with his plans for what he wanted to see in scientific development in medical school. So it sort of happened against the great majority vote of the medical faculty. And we had scrounged around looking for the money for it and so on, but it looked like it was going to be settled. Anyhow, that was sort of one of the first major policy issues, and I got to be head of a mini department, recruiting people and so on, so extra laboratory commitment. So that was the next. Ended up being a little restless with the somewhat limited horizons at Wisconsin, particularly in the medical direction. Mm-hmm. And the brand new medical school at Stanford, Art Kornberg beckoning, going out there himself and so on, decided to go out there and had, call it a misfortune, just as we were packing up to leave from Madison, the Nobel Prize comes in. Not good timing. it just doubled the kind of gritty feelings about turning my back to my friends, going somewhere else. People getting it all mixed up, saying, Stanford has recruited another Nobel Prize winner. Mm-hmm. And so, sort of nobody being able to take legitimate credit for any part of it. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, there it was. And there's no doubt a lot of the public attention that I got after 1958 was connected with the prize. But remember the stuff, the fuss I made about planetary quarantine and so on, that was before the prize announcement.